My name is Jerry, and this is the Wild Eye Podcast. What is the cost of a safari, psychologically? Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the Wild Eye Podcast. Now, this episode is the result of an idea that Don had a week or so ago, and honestly, it was quite a fun one to both talk through and just from the ideas that it brought up. So in this episode, we talk about the psychology of money, how spending money on a safari can be something that gives you more satisfaction than just being on the trip, and a bunch of other related ideas which I didn't see coming. Super interesting one. I had a great time. Don, thank you for this. I hope you guys enjoy this one and would love to hear your thoughts. Here we go.
So over the last little while, I've gone on a bit of a, do you want to call it a journey? But journey sounds so dramatic. I've been in a bit of a like reading up about things like money and the psychology behind it. I think one of the most terrific skills that anyone can have is to master the art of contentness. To actually be...
It's a good line.
It is a good
line.
It's
a good line.
Put that on your wall.
Yeah, exactly. It's a t-shirt right there.
But to do this, you have to invest in what matters to you and let go of what doesn't. So there's this book, and it's written by the author Morgan Housel, with the name The Psychology of Spending Money. And then he came up with a second book called The Art of Spending Money, which is so different to most books out there, because most books tell you how to invest, save, you know, do the opposite of spending. Where this guy unpacked the idea of actually what spending money does for you. And he mentions that most people believe financial success lies in how much you earn, save, or invest, as we just said. But he argues that how you spend your money says more about your happiness and character than any bank balance can. It's my privilege this morning, Jerry, to be able to speak to you about this and to actually hear your thoughts, because this for me is, it's a learning podcast. I actually have genuine questions that I want to know the answers to. And I thought to myself, you're what better person to ask than someone like you that really understands the psychology behind many things.
You're very kind. No, it's an exciting conversation. It really is. Before you get in, quick question for you. What would be the one main takeaway you had from the book? If you had to pick the one kind of North Star idea, what would that be?
That money can buy happiness. It's, I've always, you know, there's obviously a lot of things where people say it's better to cry in your Lamborghini than cry in some broken car.
Yeah.
But that's not quite what I mean. Like I said, I'm trying to master the art of being content. And it's a hard thing to do, but money, I think, plays a profound role in that.
Yes.
And I think what I'm taking from that book is that it actually can get you to that point.
To happiness, to contentment.
To contentment, to happiness, yes.
Okay. I mean, the question of can money buy happiness? So I did actually make some notes for this because I find it a fascinating conversation. I think one of the things that to me, when I speak to a lot of my clients, one of the things is never define yourself by something that can be taken away from you at any level of your life, your job. Some people are so into, I'm a safari guide, this is who I am. Okay, but what if you're not? Like, who are you then? Your car, you drive this Lamborghini where you can cry in. What if that gets taken away? Then what? Even your relationship. I can't define myself by my relationship because something horrible might happen. So who are you as an entity and what drives that? That's an interesting thing to me. So when we get to the conversation of money and stuff, it can, most of it can be taken away. Can an experience be taken away?
No.
It's happened. So we'll get to that down the line. I think on the money happiness thing, I don't know who said, I want to say it's Jimmy Carr. I almost think in a podcast years ago, is money doesn't buy happiness necessarily. It buffers stress.
I like that.
Right. So I like that. But that said, so let's say, for example, you live on the breadline, you've got nothing, right? It's very difficult to be happy if your needs aren't met, if you haven't got a home, food on the table, transport, whatever that is, right? So I almost think personally, money buys happiness up until the point where your basic human needs are met. From then on, I mean, how many pairs of shoes can you have? How many cars can you have? These guys who have 40 shoes and 3 cars and 5 houses, did the 4th house make you as happy as the 1st house? So I think when you look at human needs, is once those are met, check, 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 anything over that, the psychology of money for me moves then to how you spend your money. And that's kind of what you mentioned, like safaris and travel and experiences. So I think that that's an interesting space, is what are the human needs? And depending on where the conversation goes, for me and where I'm, my framework is, there's six basic human needs. Now, this is, you know, Tony Robbins is?
No.
So major, he wrote Awaken the Giant Within. He's one of America's like big guy, deep voice. He's kind of the ultimate life coach from years gone by, but he's still very active. So he used these six human needs, which is based on Abraham Maslow's hierarchy of human needs psychologically. So they are certainty, uncertainty, relevance, connection, growth, and contribution. So at any point in time, you can chase two of those. So if you're looking for certainty, a lot of people in their younger life, they look for certainty. I want to know that I have enough money to pay my house, my car, my kid's school, whatever. That's a certainty thing, right? Whereas something like connection, and it could be connection to your partner, to a calling. It could be to a community, to nature, to religion. But there's a connection side. And as we go through life, I think the psychology of money and how you meet your human need changes over time. But for me, in a short version, I think money buys happiness up until the human needs are met. And anything up to then depends on how you spend it.
Jerry, what you're actually saying now has been reflected in this book, as you can imagine. It really is. It's incredible. Yeah, it's magic. I mean, he draws this crazy analogy where it's like, it's not actually an analogy. This is real life. So They've managed to take homeless people in a study, an experiment they did, a social experiment they did.
Right.
They took homeless people and sort of asked them certain questions to sort of gauge how happy they are, how content they are with life, which you can imagine is not that high because they're homeless.
Of course.
And then they took the wealthiest of wealthy people, like billionaires. I'm not even talking millionaires. I'm talking billionaires.
Stupid money. I mean,
stupid money. Like you said, like multiple cars, multiple houses, multiple holidays in a year, whatever. And ask them the same questions. And what was significant about this is the happiness levels of the homeless people and the happiness levels of the extreme wealthy were quite similar. They were both equally unhappy.
Yeah.
Which they had different problems. That's
interesting.
But they both had problems. Mm-hmm. And that's what's amazing about this. The person that's got all of this wealth has more stress. The guy that's got no money also has lots of stress because he needs money. That guy needs people to maintain his houses, needs people to, you know, what happens in the stock market, how would it affect his stocks, all of that. So what he actually has found is to really be content, you have to be somewhere in the middle, which is what you're saying now. So
the book says this.
The book says this,
Okay.
You need to spend money up until when your needs are met.
Mm-hmm.
So a person's content if he's got enough money to send his child to school, if he's got enough money to have good medical care, if he's got enough money to be able to drive a car if you live in a city where public transport's not a thing, like we do in Johannesburg. So that's where true contentness is. And this is what, it's profound that you're mentioning this because it's really what I've been thinking about. Like, you know, everybody wants to be a billionaire, but what this study is saying that the billionaires aren't happy. So you don't, why do you want that then?
Yeah.
But then, and this was actually in a podcast that he had with Stephen Bartlett in The Diary of a CEO, where Stephen then asked him, would you need to become a billionaire to understand this? And Morgan Housel's answer was yes, because everybody would strive to get to that point because they think that's where happiness lies until they get there and they realize, oh, it's not that great.
It's one of the things that you call an unteachable lesson. Like at a young age, people know everything. Right, higher teenagers, they'll solve everything because they know everything, right? But it's an unteachable, there's many unteachable lessons in life. Like if someone's, let's say, drinking too much, you can say to them, listen, Don, if you keep down this road, it's going to end in tears. But the chances of someone taking that advice and changing their behavior, it's not going to happen. They have to, you can't teach someone that, they have to experience it. Now, for majority of us, we're not going to experience being a billionaire. But the idea of, And again, I can't remember where all these references are coming from, but we all have problems. When you have lots of money, you just have different problems. So it's much of a muchness. But to me as well, it depends on what we're chasing here. Is you mentioned contentness. Just for my reference, what do you mean by that? What does that feel like to you, to be content? Feeling you're chasing?
To be truly satisfied with where you are.
Regardless?
Regardless of money or anything else. You know what I mean? So again, I'm not trying to prove that money will bring you contentness. I'm just trying to prove that the lack of money will bring stress and too much money will bring stress.
Yeah.
So I think you need to find that balance.
Sure.
And I think in that balance, and I'm sure we'll unpack this later, is spending your money on things that you value most. For example, if you value peace, then spend it on things that simplify life. Or if you value relationships,
sure,
then spend it on shared experiences and not necessarily material things. And I think that's what I'm trying to do. That's what I define as contentment. So if I'm happy, my wife's happy, my family's happy, and we are growing together as humans, not necessarily financially, but just growing.
Yeah.
So the idea of contentment for me, how I would frame that is peace of mind, personally. So I want peace of mind knowing that I can put food on the table, that I can maybe go on a date night once a week or whatever that might be, right? But the problem with something like happiness or being rich or being healthy, those things are binary, because if you are happy, you can also be unhappy. It's a fact. There's this beautiful conversation that happened. I don't know what it is. It's a round table with a bunch of actors, and they do it once in a while. And they've got the big hitters. I mean, Tom Hanks, Al Pacino, Denzel Washington, and these guys just talk about life. And I think it was Tom Hanks that said, remember in life, this too shall pass. If things are going remarkably shitty for you, this too shall pass. It's a fact. That's life. But if things are going remarkably well, this too shall pass, right?
Yeah.
So life is this, it's this constant tick-tock between good and bad. But if you chasing happiness and if you chasing being wealthy, or not even wealthy, just being rich, right? Because there's levels to that game. But if it's binary, you can be happy, you can be unhappy. Whereas if you mention contentness, I might not be able to do a date night every month this week because, or this year, try that again, a date night every week this month because it's a tough cycle, whatever it is, I'm still going to be okay. I'm not defining my happiness by that metric. So peace of mind is when I'm okay with the status quo of my life and the people around me, whether it's good or bad. Like I feel secure, but now it comes back to, it's very difficult to feel secure when you can't pay for your house, when you can't pay for your food, and so on and so forth. So again, that metric of what is enough, it's human needs. And it's different for each of us. I mean, I don't have kids, right? So my needs are very different to, let's take Johan and Judy, for example, they've got two boys. So that as well now comes into the equation is, let's say, can I book a safari? I would probably be easier to pull the trigger because of my reality versus someone who's got two kids they have to put for the school. But and I can't speak to this, but they probably have a huge amount of fulfillment of doing that. I don't understand. So it's horses for courses, but I think overall is human needs met. Anything over that is how you manage it and how you spend it and how you feel about it and how you define yourself with or without that.
I find that interesting. So there's clearly a big difference between happiness and contentness, because like you said, happiness can change.
It's binary.
Yeah. Mm. If you stay content, that's different.
There's an amazing, you mentioned Stephen from Diary of CEO. He spoke to a monk, and I cannot remember this guy's name. It's maybe a year and a half ago. And this monk guy goes around and he teaches about life and kind of spirituality and the whole thing. And this is one of the questions that came up to him. Is Stephen asked him, are you happy? And he sat there thinking for 30 seconds and said, I can't answer the question. Today I'm happy. What about tomorrow?
Oh, wow.
Right? Because it changes. It's life will take you on journeys. One, you might have, as a guide, you might have amazing selling cycle. So after the first quarter, you get a nice little bonus or your payment goes up. 2 months from now, it doesn't happen. So does that mean you're now less of a person? You're less happy? It's that peace of mind is what I try and chase, regardless of what's happening.
Okay. Well, something else that I found really interesting is that I want to ask you about confidence, because what I find interesting is that you get a lot of people that don't necessarily have a lot of money, but they are quite confident. So is that a personality thing? Do you have certain personalities that are confident?
Yeah.
Or, but I've, in that same breath, I've come across most people that I know that do have a lot of money that are naturally confident people. So is it a personality thing, or does money give you confidence?
Sure.
What is the link between money and confidence?
Yeah, interesting question. I think for someone who has, and when we say money now, we're talking above and beyond. They're not just meeting the needs, they've got free cash, right? I think for those people, there's a lowered consequence if they mess up. Like if they have a car accident, they have insurance.
Yeah.
If the house burned down, they have insurance. They can easily go and buy a new television. They can easily go and buy. So because other people might be in a situation, if they crash their car, they have nothing. So their risk and their consequence to life messing them around is so much higher. And it's very difficult if you're dealing with that projected forward anxiety in life to be happy and to be confident, because in the back of my mind, I know, shit, if something happens, I can't buy another one. But if you have the free cash, whatever happens, so there's a lowered consequence metric for people who have a lot of cash, which means, is their confidence real, or is it almost like a financial prosthetic that they have, so that gives them that power? Whereas if you look at real confidence, if we strip the money out, real confidence is not, and this is Hormozy says, this is one of his original quotes, Stephen Hormozy, is it's not looking in the mirror and shouting affirmations to yourself. It's based on evidence. Like if I say to you, are you a good photographic safari guide? You can tell me, yes. Here's the feedback from the clients. This is what they said. There's a metric. So confidence for me is stacking evidence towards the thing that you say you're confident about. Right? But I think the money confidence theory is interesting, but the consequence for those people that have that amount of money is nothing. Let's say, for example, let's talk celebrities, right?
Yeah.
Celebrity drives, gets pulled over for DUI, for drunk driving, and has to go, and now he's got to post bail. What's the consequence? He's million strong, now he's got to pay $1,000 bail. Doesn't care.
Yeah.
You and I, they say to you now, and I'm just taking a flyer here, you get pulled over, you had a couple of drinks, they say your bail is 25,000 Rand. What are you going to feel? The consequence is kind of severe, right? So I think somewhere in that space, the confidence for, and this is not, I'm not blanket statement here. It's a lot of people, not all, because you also have to have confidence to get the money. So there's that dichotomy as well, right? But I do think that the consequence for people who have loose or expendable or more than the human needs amount of money, I think that becomes a thing.
Yeah, I think confidence is like, what I find interesting about it is the fact that confidence, I think it can be learned.
Mm-hmm.
I think if 100%. You, for example, exercise, you're going to feel more confident about your body, which means you're more confident facing people. You're more confident standing in front of a crowd and speaking to them if you want to sell something, for example.
And how did you get there? You've stacked evidence.
Yeah.
Here's my app. Look, I've run every morning for 6 weeks. There's my evidence. Yeah. So stacking the evidence is exactly.
Yeah, so that's the thing. If you're an unconfident person, then do things differently so that you can learn that confidence and have that evidence, as you say, to become confident. So it's not necessarily the money that's going to give it to you. It's just like you say, the money, people that have a lot of money, they use it as almost an insurance, as risk-free. So they have it, if something goes wrong, they're fine. They can pay themselves out of it.
Yeah.
And I think I think it can be mistaken for confidence, but it isn't necessarily confidence. It's more, they have less risk.
You wonder what would happen if we look at internal versus external. I mean, internal is me, you doing the work. You know deep down, I've done the work for this. If you get to a certain point, how do you measure your own worth? Let's say someone's very strong. Suddenly the stock markets crash. Was their self-identity attached to, I am this wealthy person? Now what? Suddenly the stock markets crash. Where's your ego going to go? Boom. Now what? It's... You don't define yourself by things that can be taken away.
Yeah.
But I think, and I can't speak to this because I haven't been in this situation, but I think people who are that wealthy, they move past the point of identifying as a rich person. They just do what they want. Think of someone like, I don't know, Jay-Z or Beyonce, right? They're a billion strong.
Mm.
Do they even budget? Do they even consider? It's not, can I afford this? It's just, I want that.
Yeah.
Suddenly it's a very, it becomes a very hedonistic thing. It's like, I just want that, I'll have it. Versus, you've earned it because you've sold 4 million albums, whatever. But it's just, that's an interesting space.
But don't you think it takes away a lot of the fun of life? I think I think that's where Morgan Housel got to the conclusion of, very wealthy people are equally as happy as people that don't even have a house.
Having things is not great.
Yeah.
Getting things is great. The process of chasing that, right? And it's a Jimmy Carr. I love him as a comedian, but his thoughts on life, if you listen to some of the podcasts, is phenomenal. He said something, show me a trust fund kid and I'll show you someone who has a tortured internal life.
Oh, wow.
Why? Because when do you work hard for something, right? Working hard for things in life is, It's why we're here, right? If you and I were still cavemen, we have to go and chase that woolly mammoth. That's hard work,
yeah.
Right? But we had to do it.
Yeah.
And I think people who, if it becomes too easy, and that's the trust fund kid example, like Jimmy said, is show me a trust fund kid. I'll show you some of the tortured. There's no drive. There's no want. And if we look at what dopamine does in the brain, it's the more molecule, right? It's not getting the cookie. It's looking for the cookie. It's smelling the cookie. It's that. But if you have all of that, especially at a young age, when you have to start learning how to get better at life, how to drive at life, what, there's something missing. Chasing is better than having.
Yeah, I agree. That's incredible. It's a great way of thinking about it. Right, so obviously spending money, and I guess this is where we're going to get to the more psychological part of it. It's not just a financial decision. Mm-hmm. It's an emotional one, right? It's you.
Well, they're spending money.
Spending money.
Yeah.
It's often you often purchase things that you value, and that's why I'm saying it's an emotional thing. It's not necessarily obviously you purchase things like food that you need, but you're going to buy food that you like. You're going to mm-hmm. buy if you don't like carrots, you're not going to buy carrots. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So I want to ask you, Jerry, like, what is the when is the right time? Psychologically, so not financially, psychologically to spend money on something like a holiday. So again, obviously, because the obvious answer if we're talking about finances is when you have the money, sure, but we're not talking about that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, when is the right time in your life to go on something like a holiday, to spend money on it?
Sure. When is the right time to spend money on a holiday?
Like, is it when you're down at work, or is it if you're going through a slump and maybe you need something that lifts you out of the slump, or when?
Interesting question. I think on the slump thing, I think if you're down in life, if you're having a tough time, I think if you're going to buy anything then, whether it's a holiday, a new pair of shoes, a new car, whatever the case is, it's not going to take the pain away. You're just kicking it down the road. You're going to come back from your holiday and the same shit's still going to be there, yeah. Right? So it needs to be why. Why do you want to book the holiday? Or why do you want to buy the shoes? Or why this thing? I mean, people get addicted to shopping. So if you're going through a tough time and you're trying to, in inverted commas, fix whatever's wrong, bad relationship, struggling at work, whatever that might be, I think it's a coping mechanism to take your attention away from it. And by doing that, shopping gives you dopamine. It's the rush. It's like going, I go into a shoe store in New York, I lose my mind, right? Love my sneakers and stuff. And my dopamine is firing. And it's the process of walking to the store. And it lifts me out of the dump of where my mood might have been. If, however, I think if you, and maybe some of our clients are like this, if you're looking to buy a holiday, if it's a part of, and I don't want the process to sound structured, like here's a spreadsheet, right? Tick, 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 let's book a holiday. But if I'm booking myself a holiday for now for March next year, a year away, right? It gives me something to focus on. It gives me something to work towards. It makes all the long hours worth it. So if I'm aware of where I am, and again, I think a lot of it is, it comes to the six human needs for me, right? What do I want? Like, I want certainty. I've booked a holiday. It's certain that I'm going there. I've paid for it. I'm going. And that dopamine carries you through. When life sucks, you know you can go and, you know what, okay, I've just got 4 more days and it's Friday, and then it's 1 weekend closer to my trip. So it's the why. And it's a very difficult thing. When should you book a holiday? Well, why? Why? Is it because you want to see the Great Migration? Is it because you want to go and fly a hot air balloon in Cappadocia? So start there. Now, let me put another concept in here. Observable and hidden metrics of a decision. So what that is, the easiest description, wow, I need more coffee. Description would be the observable metrics in life is the things we can see. So look at a CEO of a big company. We know what his salary is, right? We can see he's got 5 cars. He's got 3 houses everywhere. And he's well-respected because he's the CEO of the company. That's observable. We can metric that on a spreadsheet. What are the hidden metrics? He's probably got stress and a potential heart attack. We can't see that. His wife might be having an affair because he's never at home. His kids hate him because he's always away, right? The emotional side of it. So let's take it to a more normal situation. If someone is very overweight, you can go and say to them, okay, listen, Don, dude, if you lose weight, your pants will go from a 44 to a 38. What does that mean to you? Or I can say to you, Don, listen, if you lose some weight, you know when you sit down and it feels uncomfortable because you're sitting, that'll go away. So we are more driven by the hidden metrics in life than we are by the observable. Observable, unfortunately, is where work, relationship, a lot of stuff, we based on this, but we make decisions emotionally. So now let's go back to the question of why should you book a safari? This is not a sales, we're not selling anything.
No.
It's not that you're going to spend $15,000 on the trip, right? Because if you're looking at that, you got the money. I mean, it's there. What am I going to feel when I get there? I would work it back like that. Is what is it going to feel like the month leading up? It's that anticipation, right? I'm going to start Googling stuff. I'm building this whole experience around my future decision. And then when I eventually get there, what does it feel like? And maybe I can ask people who listen, if you've been on safari, Swabi Sands, Mala Mala, the Kenya, whatever, what does it feel when you get out of that small plane and you get that warm air in your face and you smell Africa, you smell the dirt, right? That is why you should book a safari. What is it going to feel like, right? And then you can look, okay, if that's what I want it to feel like in the future, if I work it back, what are the observable metrics I have to check in order to get that?
I see.
It comes to what is the why. But if someone's having, again, like we said, if someone's having a really tough time and they're struggling and this, that, the other, buying stuff, shopping addictions, it's just going to kick it down the road. It's not fixing it. It's putting a little plaster on a leg that's off.
Yeah. No, that's incredible. I think it's like you said, it's buying a, if you go, like you said, if you're going on safari with the mindset of, okay, no, this is going to fix me, it won't. It's not how it works.
No.
It's going to do things to you and it might change your life and the way you see things, like life is simpler out necessarily in Africa than what it is in New York City. And that's going to do stuff to you mentally. But I get what you're saying. You need to go fulfilled already, basically, and then you're going to be even more fulfilled.
Well said. I do think, though, so there's something called biophilia, right? This is the love of life. Okay. The Greek term comes from it's the love of life. I think it was 1970s that it was first came up. And it's literally, at base level for us, it's a connection to nature or living things. So the whole idea where some people, and maybe you've heard this, some clients say when they get to Africa, it's like they're going home.
Yes.
Right? Many times. Why? Because you're connecting with more life around you than you normally would. And even for me, I go home, I've got life. I've got two dogs at home, right? So that's there. But if I get to Africa, there's herds of this and you feel alive. So I think if you are going to go on a safari, with the idea of fixing yourself, whatever that means. I just want to unwind a bit. I'm too depressed. I want to kind of just relax and come back. Depression is past focus, anxiety, forward focus, right? So if you're anxious about things coming up in your life, yes, you can, because you're stepping out of the situation that causes it. And Africa is a good place because you do feel more connected. You feel more at home. You feel, for lack of a better term, earthed, right? You get some of these therapists and stuff that would take you out on grass and then you do like, you rub your toes in the mud and in the grass, connecting to earth, right? It's a bit like schwa or hug a tree for me, but that's fine. That's all good. But if you go, however, let's try this as an interesting concept. If you're going to go to Africa to fix something, whatever it is, you want to deal with an issue, you had a breakup, you want to find yourself, you've got anxious thoughts that you want to kind of process. Let's think about this. If you go on a photographic safari, what is the aim? Take. I'm going to take the image. Did you get it? Yes, I got it. Did you get the picture of it? Yes, I got it. Did you take the image? Yes, I took it. So psychologically, what are you doing? Are you focusing on you or are you seeing what you can have? Versus putting the camera down and actually just being present in the moment, because then you're open to whatever nature can give you. So biophilia, a connection with life. So if you're just going to go take, get, grr, grr, mine, I got it. How is that going to open you up to being aware of what you really want? So this is one of the things I'm looking at maybe end of this year. And this is, again, not a sales pitch, just where my mind's going, is to run immersions where you go into Africa, into the Arctic, into these beautiful places. You don't focus on photography. For example, try this. And I've done this with one. We've got time to go down a rabbit hole, right? So I had a client I was working with a couple of years ago. She had cancer. We knew she was going to die. And I worked with her for about a year and a half, coping, anxiety, kind of acceptance and all these things. And she came on a private guided trip with me once. So we both knew this was her last trip, right? And she came out, we went to Timbavati, small little tented camp, lodge, very earthy, just the two of us. And every morning she would come down. Now, someone like this had obviously a very noisy internal world. You have your voices, I have mine. Sometimes good, sometimes bad, but we all have things, right? And it comes from the human needs that are either not met or... So every morning she would come down, and while we have coffee, before we go out on our private vehicle, we would discuss and say, what are you feeling now? Like, sleep-wise, what came up for you, this, that, the other? And she would, for example, say huge amounts of anxiety. She has these moments of hope and moments of connection because she's in Africa. Okay, cool. Then what we did, we said, okay, cool. So let's use anxiety, hope, and connection on the morning drive for photography. That's our theme. We're going to try and photograph anxiety. Do you know how hard that is?
No, sure.
How do you photograph anxiety? The closest thing is probably an impala because everything eats them, right? So there's anxiety. But you then go out, and what you're doing, you're not just taking. You're literally processing what you're feeling in real time, connecting very heavily with nature, because how do you photograph hope in nature? Look, think about it. Creatively, what would you do? What would hope look like? Could it be, and if we're very creative now, could it be a little baby baboon in a marula tree reaching, almost getting the marula fruit, as an example?
Yeah.
Could it, how do you photograph acceptance? Could, and this is horrible, but maybe a lion just smashed a baby impala and mom standing in the distance and you photograph that. So if you're going into nature with, we've gone on a photographic thing here, but there is a way that if you do have things you want to fix, I do believe there's a way to do it, but you have to be then aware of what your desired outcome is. It's not to just take images. I don't like saying take images. I normally speak to my clients, we're going to make images, because at least there's a creative mindset. So, sorry, I went right down a rabbit hole there, but for me, that will be it. It's, you're not going to go there to fix yourself if you're focusing purely on photography. You also can't just go there, wherever there is, right? Sitting around a campfire, hoping things are going to miraculously just be fine, because you might sit around the campfire and then 5 days in, you're like zen as anything, right? You're super chill. 2 days later, you walk back into your apartment in New York and everything is still the same. Sure. You didn't learn coping mechanisms. You didn't learn how to deal with it, how to accept. So, and look, this opens up a lot of reasons for people to travel, as long as you're intentional and aware of it.
I just want to go back to that lady that went on a safari with you, obviously in the very difficult circumstances. The theme that you had, for example, that morning, getting those emotional photographs, how did that change it? Did she relate to the baboon reaching out to the fruit, that hope photo? Mm. Did she relate to that, or how did that change it? Could you see a change?
So there's a micro and a macro. I think every day, yes. So she would come down in the morning, if we would have coffee, and would have like a half an hour, almost like a little therapy session, just kind of dig into this stuff. But then when we were out there, we didn't talk much on the car because I gave her the stuff and then she would use. And then when it's time, like poke and prod, but she would come back, I almost want to say lighter after each drive. In the afternoons, it was more like, okay, cool, let's just do this. But the mornings, especially laying awake at night where your head goes. So she did come back lighter in the morning drives. I think if we step back on a helicopter view for her, is she knew it was her last trip. So she was, if I say to you, Don, you got one more trip to Africa, to any reserve, then it's done. You're going to soak it up as much as you can, right?
Every moment.
So she knew this was her last one. We both knew it. We spoke about it. It was some very hard conversations. Mm. But she knew. So she came out knowing. So she appreciated probably more than anybody. And when she then went back, she had the images, and we didn't even process much. It was more the process rather than the outcome. Mm. But she had those moments, those memories to remind herself. And we probably had about a 3-month runway after that, that we still looked at the stuff and spoke about, and do you remember? And look at this image. What does it bring up for you? Things like that. And then unfortunately passed away. But that, I think, looking at the helicopter view, what was that for her? And what did she get from it? It was closure. She knew this was it. It was acceptance that I'm not doing this again. So a lot of the big human needs for her probably was, let's think about this. I haven't just now. So the six human needs: certainty, uncertainty, relevance, connection, growth, and contribution. For someone like her, growth and contribution, probably not. Right? Uncertainty, huge. How do you deal with that? People often, do you like surprises? No. No, you like them when they suit you, right? Otherwise, it's a problem. So for someone like her, it's probably certainty and then connection. And those two things we could find in Africa. We could push those two that she felt they're being met.
Well, I see.
Long way of answering
this,
that.
This might be very soppy and whatever I'm saying now, but it's sad for us healthy people that we need to go to that extreme to actually mm-hmm. experience a safari like that. But imagine you could experience every safari that you can go to that way. And there's this very famous, if you just go search on YouTube, you type in blind lady visiting Londolozi. I'm sure you've seen that.
Yes, I've heard of it. I've never seen it.
It's incredible. Oof. So picture this, a blind person, never been able to see in her life, going on safari. Like, safari is all about what you see. Safari is all about, you know, the trees, the river, the animals, the... So she also had a private vehicle, and she asked the guide, listen, I can't see, obviously, so please explain to me what we're seeing.
Yeah.
And obviously, can you imagine the stress on this guide and the responsibility on this guide's shoulders?
Oh, goodness, yeah.
But turned around and been able to, even just out of Impala, explain to her what these Impalas look like, what they're doing, what they... And she said it was the most life-changing experience of her life because she could hear what he was describing and then actually imagine it for herself, whatever that looked like.
Sure.
But I think that is what safari is about.
Yeah.
And I think that's how, if you the psychology of spending your money, and if you can think about it that way, it's life-changing.
Mm.
My next question to you, Jerry, is like, can I get this from a beach holiday? Can I get this from, because you said biophilia is the word you used?
Biophilia, yeah.
The love of life. Can you get this from going to the beach, or does it necessarily need to be in Africa, or can you get this in Svalbard looking at polar bears or Borneo, orangutans? How does that work?
It's a good question. I think, what is a beach holiday, right? It's going to a place and chilling. It's pretty relaxed. You sit on the beach, you sit next to the pool, you get a drink, you maybe go jet ski for a little bit. So, and again, maybe if I look at safari, there's sometimes it's uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Right? Sometimes you're stuck in rain. It's very hot. Like if you go to the Pantanal, my goodness, it's like 47 degrees. You're sitting with an umbrella. You're sweating in this damn Pantanal. So I think because safari, and safari could be polar bears, Borneo, Africa. I think because it demands a certain amount of patience. I think because it demands a certain amount of work. You have to go look for stuff, right? Because it demands a certain amount of hardship. Sometimes people want luxury. Sometimes you have to sleep in a small little tent and there might be bugs. But if you want to see the good stuff, that's the price you have to pay. And I think that psychologically that's better for us because you feel like you're not just chilling and you're literally taking your headspace elsewhere. You're dealing with things. I know for me personally, if I go and lay on a beach, my anxiety wants to peak. I'm like, I'm not doing anything now, right? I've got nothing else to think about. I'm not looking for anything because there's the ocean's right there. I'm not looking for it. So I do think in that space of beach versus bush, and it's a great combination, right? It's a good combo. But for me, I think the implied hardship, the patience that's required, the uncertainty thereof makes it peaks exciting. Maybe even the disappointment. You're not going to, what's the biggest disappointment you get at the beach? It's a cloudy day. Cool, so I'm going to watch Netflix all day or sit inside and drink at the inside bar, if that's your thing. But all of the variables that safari offers leaves it open-ended. And because it's open-ended, like, am I going to see a spirit bear? Like, let me, example, right? A couple of years ago, it was my third trip up to the Great Bear Rainforest. And you go there for the spirit bears, which is it's a white black bear. It's a double recessive gene, right? And there's one lady and her two sons, that was their thing. They needed to see this thing. And the whole trip's amazing. We've got grizzlies, there's whales breaching. It's amazing. And on the last 2 days, we go to Gribble Island, which is where these bears are. And what you do, you sit on these platforms next to the creeks, and these things hunt up and down. So hopefully, saw some black bears on the first day, nothing. We got one more day. We get there, and by like 10 o'clock in the morning, I'm like, oh, you see, there's not a bear yet. Gets to like 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, we're leaving at 5. And in my mind, I'm having the worst day of my life because these people, this is it. Anyway, we don't see this thing. So the trip now is basically finished. Now we've got to go back. We get on the Zodiacs, we transfer back, and they're all in tears, right? Literally, because this, as a family, that's what they wanted to see for so long, right? Now, it sounds horrible, but was that memorable for them, right? It was uncertainty at the highest degree, and it didn't happen, but there was still some kind of connection.
Yeah.
Whereas if I, and this is sometimes the issue with some of the reserves, is if you go to Mala Mala, you're pretty much going to see a leopard.
Yeah.
Doesn't that take away from it a bit? Certainty, uncertainty. Mm-hmm. So you need to know what you're going for. But for me, beach versus bush, I think beach is great. Relax, do your thing. But if you're wanting to, and I don't know if this works, if you want to work on yourself, mentally you got stuff to deal with, I think you're going to get more from something that has an uncertain element, a patient element, you're dealing with hardship, you're going to come out better.
What I'm hearing here is that it's because safari is just more relatable. It's you can relate with your everyday life,
mm-hmm.
the ups, the downs that life offers you in your job.
Yeah.
You're seeing it in a natural way, like out. So
sure.
I just think that's more relatable, where going to the beach is you are almost removed from reality because you sit and do nothing. Like you said, none of us just sit and do nothing in our real lives.
Yeah.
So that's also good because you relax that way.
Sure.
But on a safari, why it's such a connection, why it's such a different kind of holiday is because you relate to it. The searching for things, we're all chasing something, whatever that is.
Sure.
And it's good because that's what motivates you. That's 100%. What drives you. That's where you get your dopamine. As you said, it's the looking for stuff, not the having it.
Mm-hmm.
That's safari. Safari is you're looking for something. You don't know what you're going to get. Every morning, you might drive the same road, but tomorrow is different to today.
Mm.
And I think that's just more relatable.
There's something called the small self effect. So I think it was Amy Grant, if I'm not attributing this quote wrong, said, go watch a sunset, go watch a sunrise. Whether it makes you feel big or small, you're right. Okay, so the small self kind of theory is that when you do things in life that makes you feel small, right, it breaks your ego down.
Mm.
It breaks your ego down and it brings you more back to the base, right? So if you look at psychology, there's the awe, right? I'm in awe of something.
Hmm.
Let me ask you this. When was the last time you were totally in awe of something? When was that for you?
You know what? This is going to be ironic, but it probably was when I was on safari last time. Seeing it was my first time in the Masai Mara, so it was...
It was that scale.
It was those big skies. It was just something I'm used to. South African safaris, Botswana safaris with lots of foliage. It was just so different to what I'm used to.
Mm.
And that was an awe moment for me.
So awe is, it's a psychological concept that helps with positivity and gratitude. Right? So just on a side, the framework I approach with my clients is fourfold. Resilience, agency, positivity, and gratitude. And with that, you can work any mindset. Awe speaks to positivity and specifically gratitude. Now, let's think about this. If you get to the beach, right, you fly into Mauritius or Seychelles, wherever you get there, you get to your room. Oh, this is amazing. Open the door. Oh, that's amazing, right? You get to the beach. Oh, this is amazing. What about day 6?
Yeah.
Okay, so it's still amazing and you're grateful for it. But the level of awe that nature, wildlife, whether it's an orangutan up a tree, whether it's a lion crossing the Mara River, which I still have to see, but that injection of awe over and over and over again, it literally breaks the ego down because you start feeling small in this big picture.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, have you been into a rainforest ever?
Yeah, I have.
Okay. I've never felt smaller. Mm. You walk and there's these trees that are like 50, 60 meters tall. I feel this big. Not just physically, but you feel like, do I really matter? And that's good. So I do think that idea of awe and having it again and again and again on a safari is amazing. The thing that people need to understand, though, is you can look for that. You can be in awe of something if you, and now I'm going to mess this up. I think it's Henry Miller. He was an American author and playwright. And he wrote something, I'm going to totally butcher this, but it was something like, if you look closely enough and long enough at anything, there's a sense of awe. Right? So if I sit in this, we're sitting in the Wild Eye studio here. If I start looking at this plant behind me or this, and I go really close and I spend time, even if it's just for 30 seconds, I'm going to be in awe of something. I can look for it. Yeah. Whereas safari normally is so big, it slaps you in the face for most people, especially if it's your first or second trip. What's sad is some people who have the means, they come back on safari again and again and again, and they tend to just turn into, well, this was not good enough because I didn't get the images. You're missing it. You can't lose that. You can't lose. One of the things I do, and I've done this for the longest time, is both on personal trips and on safaris with people, every single time, and this is from way back when I was hosting like 20 trips a year, is on the last morning, let's do the Mara camp, on the last morning before we check out, I will break away from the clients and I'll go and stand or sit somewhere and just literally just try and convince myself, this is the last time you're seeing this.
Wow.
Like Longyearbyen, where we start Svalbard from. On the last day, we normally have like an hour and a half, 2 hours after getting off the boat before we go to the airport. And the guests are like, can we, I make a point of going on my own, walk around town, go kind of up on the hill so you can look down at the town. Just, and I've done this for many years. And I say to myself, you try and convince you, take this in because this could be the last time you ever see this. And it just anchors you in the moment. It's important.
It is. It's so valuable. And this, again, it's, there's too few people that experiences that. I think we live in a world where it's so, you rather want to fly to somewhere in Europe to see these old buildings, which is also amazing. History, traveling for historical reasons is incredible, but it's still there tomorrow. It's still there next week. It's still there. Mm. I think going on a safari is just so different. It's just, it really is a different kind of holiday. Mm. And I think for all the reasons you've just described.
Mm.
Jerry, is there anything else that you feel like we haven't said that we should have, or concept?
Good question. I think that a lot of people, when they're deciding whether to spend money on a safari or not, again, what am I buying for it? What are you getting for your $10,000, $5,000, $15,000, $20,000? Right? So for me, I'm not scared, and this is just a link in, I'm not scared to spend money on a good restaurant. Right? Why don't I go to Spur? Okay, because I don't have children. Spur, for the international people listening, it's a very it's South Africa's probably biggest, most famous, like, family restaurant. They've got an area where the kids can go play. The kids are running all over the place. Like, that's not me.
Yeah,
I'm happy to spend slightly more of a premium if it's the it's not just the food, it's the experience, it's the service, it's the ambience. It's, where am I driving out to Hartbeespoort or Dumfries, because that's part of the experience. So if someone's buying a Svalbard trip, and $18,000, I'm not sure what it is, you're not just getting 9 days on the boat. It's 10 months worth of looking forward to it. It's being in a random conversation, hearing the words Svalbard, you're like, ooh, and your brain's got, it processes stuff differently. So the whole idea of, what do we say, like buyer's remorse. Oh man, I didn't really have the money. Yeah, but are you getting something for it? Or are you getting an experience for it? Because like you said in the beginning, is what we said, don't define yourself by something that can be taken away. If you bought another watch, you can lose it, you can take it away. If you buy this experience, and the experience can't be taken away from you, but if you double down on awe and you make sure you're present during it, you're not just focusing on take. Some people want to go and give back to communities, or you just make sure that you get the most, or lose your ego and just be small in that situation. Nobody's taking that away. So you're not just buying 9 days on a boat, or 7 days in the Mara camp, or 6 days at Londolozi. It's so much more.
Yeah, I think another way to gauge that is, if you buy that watch today, will you still talk about that watch in a year's time? If you go to Svalbard today for 9 nights, I bet you you'll still talk about it next year.
100%. I got a message, funny enough you say that. Now, over the weekend, there was a lady, South African lady, who came with us to the Mara in 2014 or 15. Her and a daughter and her husband. I got a message from her this weekend on Instagram saying, hey, saw this picture of her crossing shot, right? And that image, because she was there, triggered. And she said, that was still now, and this is now, what, 11 years later, one of the things they speak about most. That's what it's about. If she bought herself a new hairdryer, a pair of shoes, or a new car, she's still talking about the new car she got 11 years ago?
No.
Probably not.
The funny thing is, when people do talk about cars, it's about the experiences they've had with that car. It's not about the car itself. They don't talk 10 years later about how much horsepower this car has and how expensive it was. No, that's not what you talk about.
100%.
It's about, you remember that time you drove with this old broken down car to this place? That's what people talk about. And I think, again, that's experience. That's not a materialistic thing.
Hmm.
Jerry, thank you. I think I've learned a lot, and I'm sure lots of our listeners have learned a lot.
It's a fun conversation.
It is. It is really fun.
Good idea.
It's a different angle of thinking about spending your money on a safari. My hope is that somebody out there would have listened to this and really realized that, listen, yes, money can buy you. I think I'm going to change that word happiness to contentness. Money can get you to that point if you spend it on things that you value and not necessarily materialistic things. Thank you for your time. I appreciate it, and we'll do it again soon.
That was phenomenal, Don. Thank you.
Thanks.
Good stuff.
All right.